Now, in a session like this on post-liberal theology, where you have a bunch of different people, all of whom studied at the same place at the same time, the worry is that it turns into old home week, with a lot of some anecdotes of the old days. Professor Marshall clearly avoided that. It appears that Professor Buckley will also give something more substantive. I'm afraid I am the old home week presentation, where I want to ask, what is post-liberal theology? Was there a Yale school, and why care? 4 or 5 years ago, a student asked me whether I was a follower of post-liberalism. I was a bit taken aback. It was a question I had not thought about in a good while. After some brief thought, I answered that I wasn't sure, because I wasn't sure what post-liberalism was, or even if there was such a thing. The answer seemed to baffle the student. Shouldn't I know? After all, so to speak, I was there. I was a graduate student at Yale during the foundational years of post-liberal theology in the 1970s. I followed the path of George Lindbeck into ecumenical work, and I published essays on theology and narrative theory in the 1980s. I may be a minor member of the Yale School, perhaps least among the apostles, but I too, like Saul, one would think would be among the prophets. My views were not always so diffident. I remember one of the annual gatherings of some of the former Yale grad students, which used to occur here every summer at the Dominican House. We were sitting out in the courtyard in the middle after dinner. This is sometime in the mid or late 1980s. We were discussing whether we wished to write some kind of book that would exemplify what we, and we thought our teachers, were advocating. But was there sufficient agreement among us or among our professors to produce such a work? And did we represent something that could rightly be called post-liberalism? Ronald Thieman, later dean of the Harvard Divinity School and a leader among the former grad students, thought we didn't agree. Yes, there was a certain kind of shared outlook, but he doubted whether there was enough agreement on either substantive or methodological issues to produce a common work. In addition, he was uncomfortable with the term post-liberal, which he thought might carry implications of a reactionary and problematic sort. At that time, he carried the day. We didn't produce such a book. The group of us later did produce a book in which the word post-liberal does not appear a single time. I was on the other side of that discussion many years ago. I thought there was enough of a shared outlook to produce something. Over time, however, I have come to doubt that opinion. This presentation has been an opportunity to revisit the question about post-liberalism and a so-called Yale School. I must say it has been a somewhat unsettling experience, deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra famously said. On the one hand, it was pleasant to return to memories of what was a wonderful place to study theology. As will probably be said a number of times during this conference, Yale from the early 1970s, when the theological faculty took a stable form with Hans Frey, George Lindbeck, and David Kelsey at the center, through 1988, when Hans Frey sadly died, was an exciting place. Something was being done. And it was a congenial place. I think most of us who were there at the time still remember it as a bright point in our lives. Would that everyone has such an experience of studying theology. But on the other hand, as I worked through this material again for this presentation, I could not escape a sense that it also grasped me a few years ago, when for the first time in a good while, I reread straight through, first page to last page, George Lindbeck's The Nature of Doctrine. The book struck me very much as a creature of the late 1970s and early 1980s when he wrote it. It breathed an atmosphere permeated by talk of Thomas Kuhn, Peter Berger, the hope stirred by the ecumenical dialogues, the theologian's discovery of Wittgenstein. When I first read it, the book provoked enthusiasm. Now, it provoked nostalgia. The present question, I think, is less what post-liberalism is and more what it was and its present historical significance. If post-liberalism ever existed as a theological position or school or movement, as a distinct movement, it now lies, I think, primarily in the past. One can trace its trajectory. Entry into the public eye with the 1974 publication of Hans Frey's two books, The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative and The Identity of Jesus Christ. The creation of the Narrative Theology Group in the American Academy of Religion around 1980, creating a center for the discussion within American theological scholarship. The publication of Lindbeck's Nature of Doctrine in 1984. The publication then in the following years of a steady stream of impressive publications by students of Frey and Lindbeck, Ronald Thieman, William Plaker, Bruce Marshall, Catherine Tanner among them. But over the last 15 years, energy has run low. Frey's death meant that his study of the interaction of internal and external factors in theology was cut short and published in a less than final form as the book Types of Theology. Lindbeck's attention turned away from the methodological concerns of the nature of doctrine and turned to the more substantive matters of ecclesiology. Two of the students most explicitly concerned with continuing a line of Yale or post-liberalism, Ronald Thieman and William Plaker, both unfortunately died in their 60s. As has been noted by various commentators, on the other hand, also, some of the students of Lindbeck became Catholic, with an inevitable change in focus. Already in 2006, 11 years ago, Paul DeHart could publish a book entitled The Trial of the Witnesses, The Rise and Decline of Post-Liberal Theology, the opening chapter of which contains actually a pretty good history, if you want one, of the rise and decline of post-liberal theology. One can still find persons using the term post-liberalism to describe a contemporary theological option, and that option still has its explicit advocates, but they are not many. They are often now students of the students of the original Yale faculty. Faculty of the 19th century, not the original Yale faculty of 1703, but the, right, they are getting long in the tooth. They're often as students of the original Yale faculty of the 1970s and 80s. As DeHart notes, to say that post-liberalism is now something of the past does not mean that it failed or that what it's advocated is still not present. As he argues, a significant factor in blurring the profile of post-liberalism was that certain of its commitments have come to be widely shared by a very wide range in contemporary theology. Most notably, the approach to scripture advocated by Frey and Lindbeck, a much greater openness to a more literary, non-historical reading, attention to typology, appreciation for pre-critical exegesis. This has now become commonplace and embodied in such publications as the Brazos Theological Commentary Series. Frey's advocacy of Barth's approach to scripture no longer looks idiosyncratic. It did look idiosyncratic in 1975. It doesn't today. Lindbeck's sociology of knowledge grounded call for a sociologically sectarian but theologically Catholic form of Christianity looks in some ways a lot like what's called the Benedict option, although that may be illuminating the less than clearly defined by the less than clearly defined, I will admit. In this presentation, I want to ask, in a rather oblique way, what post-liberalism was in its heyday and what it signifies for present theology, particularly Catholic theology. That's the why care of my title. I think post-liberalism does have some lessons to teach us who are Catholics, seeking a faithful, broadly speaking, perhaps conservative theology in our time. But what are these lessons? First, let me ask the question that perplexed me when the student asked it so long ago. What just is or was post-liberalism or post-liberal theology? That question is more difficult than you might think. There was never a manifesto stating what post-liberalism was for or what it was about. The source of modern wisdom that we all check, although we never admit it, Wikipedia. There is an article on post-liberal theology in Wikipedia, and I did read it. Identifies post-liberal theology with narrative theology, an equation that Hans Frey was rejecting by the time, in fact, Lindbeck published his book. And that article makes the case, what it reads post-liberal theology as centering, on the framing quality of the overarching biblical narrative as what was decisive about post-liberalism. On the other hand, DeHart, in his book that I mentioned earlier, defines post-liberalism only negatively. It is a construction of an approach self-consciously distinct from liberal, modernist, or revisionist theologies. In the book The Modern Theologians, an essay on post-liberalism by Bill Plaker, another one of the Yale graduate students of the 70s, makes no attempt to give an overall picture and simply describes the theology of a variety of different theologians. Chad Pecknold, who we'll hear from tomorrow, in his interesting book Transforming Post-Liberal Theology, finds the defining characteristic of post-liberal theology as exemplified by Lindbeck. He makes no attempt to try and describe the whole group, just Lindbeck. He finds the decisive element in, quote, its greater descriptive attentiveness to the mediatorial capacity of signs. Now, perhaps you think what we need to do then is leave behind these secondary authors and go to the primary authors. What did they mean when they used such words as post-liberal? I'm afraid that doesn't help us much. Frey rarely used the term post-liberal, and when he did, it meant something of a different sort than it came to mean for Lindbeck. In Frey's very early work, this doctoral dissertation of more than 600 pages, he uses the word post-liberal, but he uses it to refer to the period following World War I in Germany, the interwar years, the collapse of the old liberal consensus in Protestantism, the rise of people like Karl Barth. Whether Frey, in fact, ever understood himself as a post-liberal theologian, I think is doubtful. True, William Plaker referred to Frey as the preeminent exemplification of post-liberal theology. And Jason Springs, in his 2010 study of Frey, he entitled it Towards a Generous Orthodoxy, Prospects for Hans Frey's Post-Liberal Theology. However, in the first pages of the book, he states that Frey's work has generally been misinterpreted by trying to understand it as a form of something called post-liberalism. Puts the book in the title, then undercuts it before page 10. One of the primary aims, in fact, of Paul DeHart's Rise and Fall of Post-Liberalism is to distance Frey from Lindbeck, taking Lindbeck to be paradigmatically post-liberal. Frey doesn't really fit the paradigm. Frey has much to offer, but it hasn't been taken up because people have read Frey through the lens of Lindbeck as if there were a consistent thing, post-liberalism, that the two of them represented. Even in the case of Lindbeck, the source of the term post-liberal, in the present context, we can be left in doubt. After all, the title of Lindbeck's famous book, or the subtitle, refers to a post-liberal age, the nature of doctrine, religion, and theology in a post-liberal age. The adjective post-liberal refers to a way of thinking that is not specifically theological, that Lindbeck saw emerging in the wake of a cultural liberalism, not just in theology, but more widespread. Thus, the appeals to Wittgenstein, the sociology of knowledge, and Clifford Geertz, the anthropologist. who note that in a conversation about 10 years ago, over drinks before a conference like this, Limbeck told me he wasn't sure he had ever referred to himself as a post-liberal theologian in print. Take that for what it's worth. The widely reprinted last chapter of The Nature of Doctrine, entitled Toward a Post-Liberal Theology, does focus much more sharply on theology. Here, post-liberal theology approaches clearer definition. The term post-liberalism is used four times. Amazon is great when you do the look in the book and you can do word searches. So I can say post-liberalism appears precisely four times. And he refers to such things as post-liberal method. But if we are looking for a theological position that might typify some larger group or an ism, then the last chapter of The Nature of Doctrine says both too little and too much. Too little, in that it actually is, as Limbeck himself notes about the whole book, pre-theological. It neither states nor implies any particular position on the substantive questions of theology, although it does imply some basic methodological moves that move theology perhaps in a conservative traditional direction. But I would note the exact content of traditional conservative depends on the tradition. If I were a Quaker or a universalist, Unitarian Universalist, a Limbeckian thing might move me to be more purely Theodore Parker or Ralph Waldo Emerson-like and make no compromise with Catholics, who are more prominent today than they were in the 1840s. There's no theological content specifically, deliberately. Limbeck says this is a pre-theological book meant to be ecumenically neutral in its analysis. So in one sense, the last chapter says too little to define a position. On the other hand, it says too much to identify a larger movement, because it is still tightly interwoven with an analysis and concepts that remain to a great degree identified with Limbeck and were not taken up explicitly by his colleagues at Yale. One can simply stipulate that post-liberalism simply is what Limbeck describes in the last chapter of The Nature of Doctrine, but if the term is meant to describe a larger movement, that won't quite work. Now, I should add here a kind of anomaly about The Nature of Doctrine and the method it recommends. For both The Nature of Doctrine and a significant amount of Hans Frey's work, an oddity is that there were works about theological method that if one followed through and did theology as they recommended, it would result in a theology that did not sound like their methodological analyses. To do theology in a post-liberal manner rather than talk about post-liberal theology would produce discussions steeped in the first-order discourse of Christian life, Bible, liturgy, the language of Augustine, Aquinas, Luther, not texts steeped in the language of Wittgenstein, Peter Berger, and Thomas Kuhn. Limbeckian method should lead to a theology that does not sound like the Limbeck of The Nature of Doctrine. The language of Schleiermacher's method in the opening of his Glaubenslehre permeates all his theology. For Limbeck, the analysis that sets up the method is then left behind. It permits you to do a different kind, more traditional kind of theology. I think this difference points to a different intention that lies behind the methodological proposals of, on the one hand, Schleiermacher, Tillich, Bultmann, or the Tracy of Blessed Rage for Order on the one hand, and Frey and Limbeck on the other. The first group wanted to justify a new way of doing theology, and thus their method would permeate that new way of doing things. In a sense, Frey and Limbeck wanted to give a new justification for a traditional way of doing theology, continuing on in a more traditional form. I remember a conversation once in the 80s at the American Academy of Religion. A colleague gotten to know was a University of Chicago graduate, a Tracy student, fellow Lutheran teaching at a seminary at the time, said what he did like about us Yale types was that we could get to discussing dogmatic topics so quickly. I thought, Well, that's kind of odd. I mean, just pick up the book, read it, and start talking about it. I mean, it's not an achievement to do this. And I realized, no, what he meant was you had to have this enormous methodological startup. What happened with Lindbeck and Fry was mostly getting a whole bunch of stuff out of the way. And then you could go about doing theology somewhat like Augustine or Aquinas or Luther. Not, you didn't need this enormous apparatus to get you going. There's a certain odd self-canceling quality to the methodological works of Fry and Lindbeck. I think it's one reason it doesn't show up as a school in the same way as some others. Now, all of this is to say that a description of something called post-liberalism or post-liberal theology that would be shared by at least George Lindbeck and Hans Fry, perhaps also by Plaker, Thiemann, Hauerwas, and Marshall, is at least very difficult and probably would end up tilting either toward Fry or Lindbeck, one or the other. I want to take a somewhat different tack here. Before the publication of The Nature of Doctrine in 1984, which gave us the label post-liberal, there was already talk, particularly coming out of the AAR meetings, of a Yale school. I will suggest, and here I do want to be somewhat tentative, that it might be more fruitful to think about the contemporary significance of the Yale school of the 1970s and 80s than to think of the contemporary significance of something called post-liberalism. Of course, many take the two terms, post-liberalism and Yale school, as just two names for the same thing. But that is to take school as a metaphor for a theological position or constellation of such positions. I mean school much more literally, a community in which one studies, learns, and writes, in which senior scholars pursue their projects, and junior scholars are formed in the discipline. Yale was a cohesive school in the 1970s and 80s, not so much in the sense, say, that Thomism is a school, but more perhaps in the way in which the Dominican House of Studies is a school, a learning community, a research community, a theological community. I would say the Yale school was unified by three things at least. Some common concerns, although different ways of addressing that concern, a common syllabus in the largest sense, a common sense of who simply must be read, who is less necessary but worthwhile, who can be safely skipped, and who is a complete waste of time. And united third, by a shared sense of the intellectual virtues that should be pursued, exemplified in varying degrees by the senior scholars and inculcated, again, with varying degrees of success, in the younger scholars. Yale, in the foundational years of post-liberal theology, was a cohesive school in the sense that I laid out, which I'm going to go into more detail, and I think there are things to be learned from it. First, there was, in fact, a common concern that, at least in my memory and looking at their writings again, I think did unify the Yale School of the 70s and 80s. A concern about the high liberal tradition of theology, whose progenitor and greatest exemplar was and remains Friedrich Schleiermacher, professor at the University of Berlin, writings early as 1799, running through the late 1820s. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, that liberal tradition had reasserted itself in American theology in a particularly, I would say, problematic form. Now, I'm being polemical. The highly reductive theologies of men like Gordon Kaufman, Schubert Ogden, Langdon Gilkey, and I would say the David Tracy of Blessed Rage for Order. Now, with the exception of the last, David Tracy, these are names probably unknown to most of you, and I would say rightly unknown. Don't go out and read them. My memory is of a strong general sense that at Yale, that alternatives, more traditional, more faithful alternatives needed to be offered to the paths of theological deconstruction that were on offer elsewhere. Now, but I've used the language concern about rather than simple opposition to the liberal tradition. While the negative judgment about theologies of Kaufman or Ogden or the early Tracy were strong, Fry especially, like Karl Barth for that matter, had a nuanced appreciation for the tradition and especially for Schleiermacher. Part of the problem was that Fry saw the worthwhile elements in Schleiermacher being submerged in the problematic position he saw in the early David Tracy. My sense, in the mid-1980s, when Fry was working on his types of theology and was seeking to interrelate Barton Schleiermacher, was that he was trying to rescue Schleiermacher from David Tracy. He wanted to somehow create a slightly different Schleiermacher than the Schleiermacher of the image of David Tracy. Lindbeck also was not a confessionalist who just rejected the liberal tradition, although Tracy accused him of that in a symposium edited by Archbishop DeNoia in the Thomas, where he said that Lindbeck offered, quote, a methodologically sophisticated version of Bardian confessionalism. The hands may be the hands of Wittgenstein and Goetz, but the voice is the voice of Karl Barth. Now, there are true confessionalists in Protestant theology. Think of the Dutch Calvinists, such as Berkauer, who attacked Barth from the right, or the Missouri Synod Lutherans, with whom Lindbeck dealt with in the Ecumenical Dialogues. These were something quite different from anything Fry or Lindbeck were seeking. Even theology in the mold of Barth, certainly the inspiration for Fry, was really not quite what was being advocated or done at Yale. It is odd, it seems to me, for anyone to attack The Nature of Doctrine as a Bardian book which constructs the method for dogmatic theology from secular philosophy and social science. Barth would be spinning in his grave. Yale was Barth-ish, not quite Bardian. I mean, you can't construct. Barth would get you to his method by a doctrine of revelation, not by reading Clifford Geertz and Ludwig Wittgenstein. A question that I find haunts me in considering the theologies of Yale in the 1970s and 80s is how they relate to the long series of attempts in Protestant theology dating back to the early 19th century to find a third way between a biblicist or repristinationist conservatism on the one hand. Realize, repristination is not a word Catholics use, I don't think. Repristination theology was an attempt to go back in the 19th century to a pure version of Protestant scholasticism. The Missouri Synod in this country is the best example. When they founded a Missouri Synod Lutheran Seminary, they actually used an 18th century Protestant scholastic handbook. You can buy today, that buyer's compendium, and it's a straightforward, old-fashioned handbook. On the one hand, to try a third way between a biblicist or repristinationist theology on the one hand and a reductive liberalism on the other. You have a long tradition here, various mediating theologies of 19th century German Protestantism, the Erlangen school of the Lutherans, the differing neo-orthodoxies of both H. Richard and Reinhold Niebuhr, and in a sense, even the Schleiermacher of the 1820s, who sought a way between the unmoving conservatisms of the Brandenburg Church and the neologians, as they were called, like Johann Salomo Zeimler, who subjected the gospel to the norms of enlightenment. Schleiermacher himself, I would argue, was in a sense the primal neo-orthodox theologian. Certainly, the Schleiermacher of the Glaubenslehre, his great systematic theology. A piece by Gary Dorian in the Christian Century on post-liberalism in 2001, in fact, had the title, A Third Way in Theology? I remember already reading that at the time and wondering, uh-oh, is that what we're doing? The history of these attempts to find a third way I find not encouraging. They have a tendency to attract interest for a while and then fall off in one direction or the other, a repristinationist side or a liberal side. Was post-liberalism or the Yale School another attempt to find an elusive Protestant third way, a mediating theology of a center that is faithful but still open? Say, an attempt that I now, as a Catholic, believe to have with it certain insuperable problems. I think, in fact, the Yale theologies were, in a sense, one way of reading them, is another moment in the search for that elusive Protestant third way. But I don't think that's all they were. They were more than that. After all, the work of Lindbeck has as his primary interlocutor Bernard Lonergan, not an example. Even if the primary examples, I think, in Lindbeck's head of expressive experiential theology are, in fact, Protestants, and most notably Schleiermacher. The Catholic theologian, I don't think, can say, look at Lindbeck in particular and say, here are a bunch of problems that don't concern us. On the one hand, as many examples could show, the methodological moves of Schleiermacher or Tillich can and have been sometimes appropriated by Catholic theologians, sometimes with disastrous results. I remember a comment once in grad school by Hans Frey that it appeared that Catholics were going to try and make all the mistakes that took Protestantism 150 years they'd make in 20. But on the other hand, as Frey, especially in his last writings, noted, there is a nuanced range of options of how theology resists and appropriates non-theological thought, the non-theological thought world. Catholic theology, with its dogmatic commitment to a kind of inescapable natural knowledge of God and a deep intertwining of philosophy and theology in its history, deeper than Protestantism, needs to consider how it moves forward with conceptual vigor at a time of particular intellectual chaos, genuinely engaging without accommodating. Contemporary Catholic theology faces a different situation than Protestant theology 40 years ago. I'm losing my place on the page, excuse me. Than Protestant theology 40 years ago, but the analogies are real. I am not sure what I want to say about the lessons that come from the engagement with Protestant liberalism 40 years ago and the present situation of Catholic theology. I'm particularly interested to hear what Professor Buckley and Archbishop DeNoia might say, who were themselves Catholics at Yale in the 70s, as opposed to, say, Professor Marshall and I, who were not Catholics and thus came with a rather different set of concerns. Did they see the Yale theology at the time as embedded in a set of intra-Protestant arguments, and what is its wider significance? Now, my topic, again, I'm going to get back to it at some point, is that there was a distinctive Yale school. And again, I do think a concern with the heritage of liberalism, concern, opposition with some of its particularly problematic forms of the early 70s, but an appreciation there's something there you just can't kick out, shaped the school. It was a common concern. Beyond a shared concern, there was also a shared syllabus in a certain extended sense. Despite real differences among the faculty, there was a widely shared agreement on who needed to be read, who was optional, who was a waste of time. Here I don't mean what was assigned in texts, but what was universally assumed to be central and necessary if you wanted to participate in the conversation. I do think schools are to a significant degree characterized by the books they implicitly include in an ideal syllabus. My memory at Yale is that Barth and Schleiermacher were the magnetic poles that set the magnetic field in which all the iron shavings found their place. One had to have at least read some of the major texts of Barth and Schleiermacher, or at least be able to fake it pretty well, to participate in the inevitable debate that always takes up the lives of graduate students. I would stress the presence of Schleiermacher on the list. One quickly learned that a rapid and uninformed dismissal of Schleiermacher earned you no points. Frey stressed Barth's negative reaction to Emil Brunner's thoroughly negative book on Schleiermacher, Die Mystik und das Wort, Mysticism and the Word. Schleiermacher had to be engaged, and there was much to learn from him, even if in the end you judged his project a disaster. I say sometimes the same thing to some students about early Rahner. He's a deeply learned theologian with an intention of serving the church, from whom an enormous amount can be learned, even if in the end you think there are deep problems with his project. There were theologians who definitely were not on the communal syllabus. A 1977 survey of American seminary education, I think this means Protestant, found that the theologian most assigned to be read was Paul Tillich. Not a page of Tillich was ever assigned me at Yale. He was not on my comprehensive reading list. Nor was Bultmann taken with great seriousness as a theologian. Distinctly remember the summer of 1974, I ran into Hans Frey in the parking lot of the religion department, and I suggested, I had quite enthusiasm for Bultmann when I was young and foolish, And I said, you know, I think the department should send a telegram to Rudolf Bultmann congratulating him on his 90th birthday. Yeah, see, Buckley knows it. He'll laugh. I got this blank look, and I don't think he said a word. He just got in his car, and that idea died. It was not worthy of even discussion. Nor were the negative judgments only speaking to, the left. Bart's more flat-footed colleague, Emil Brunner, was described by Fry once as a wooden second-rate epigone. We were taught to make that kind of judgment. Bad work is bad work, even if its heart is in the right place. There were two other items on this communal syllabus that should be mentioned. First, Lindbeck's interest in Catholic theology, particularly Rahner and Lonergan, meant that there was a certain level of interest in Catholic theology, as can be seen from the dissertations for Lindbeck done by DeNoia, Buckley, and Bruce Marshall, all of which involved Rahner. I would note the oddity of this. The 25 years after Vatican II saw the growth of a Catholic scholarly interest in Protestant theology. Books appeared featuring a Catholic engagement with Barth or Bultmann. The Catholic School of Luther Studies, with roots in the interwar years and the work of Joseph Lortz, thrived. What did not much develop actually was a parallel Protestant interest in Catholic theology. Protestant studies of Rahner or Congar were few that I can remember. In fact, the few I can find were written by George Lindbeck. Beyond the Swede, Per Erik Persson, and High Church Anglicans, such as Eric Maskell and Austin Farrer, I cannot think of a Protestant theologian at that time engaging Thomas the way, say, Otto Hermann Pesch engaged Luther. That's one, then, item. Catholic theology was on the agenda. Second, and this I'm going to go into in some detail, in some ways decisive for the tone of post-liberal theology, was analytic philosophy as practiced at Oxford and Cambridge in the mid-20th century. Not just Ludwig Wittgenstein, but also Gilbert Ryle, J.L. Austin and others, Strawson. To a degree, these figures were brought into the discussion by Paul Holmer, who taught philosophy of religion at Yale Divinity School, but his idiosyncratic integration of the idiosyncratic Wittgenstein and the idiosyncratic Kierkegaard was really not all that influential beyond a few well-defined disciples. Rather, these philosophers showed up for many of us in the way Lindbeck presented his rule theory of doctrine at the outset of his course on comparative dogmatics. It was comparative dogmatics when I took it. It had become comparative doctrine. I think Lindbeck got tired of the course being called comp dogs and changed it from dogmatics to doctrine. The philosophers were a standard part of comprehensive reading lists for comprehensive exams. As I will note later, the qualities of mind favored by this sort of philosophy were the qualities of mind that were valued and fostered at Yale at that time. The interest in analytic philosophy was deepened in the second generation of post-liberals, for example, in Ronald Thieman's use of Wilfred Sellers in Revelation and Theology, and Bruce Marshall's use of Donald Davidson and others in Trinity and Truth. I would note two important effects or implications of this turn to a particular sort of Anglo-American philosophy, both of which represent openings, if slightly ambiguous openings, to Catholic theology. First, by turning away, philosophically, from the idealist picture of God as transcendental ground, the path was open for a return to a more traditional philosophical picture of discussing God through a complex apparatus of analogical and metaphysical strategies. As James Fodor notes, however, post-liberal theology has shown, quote, a certain pragmatic tentativeness in its metaphysical or ontological commitments. Now, I don't think this hesitancy is just a function of pragmatism. Rather, we encounter here a way in which the Yale theologies were post-liberal rather than pre-liberal. They do not share, on the one hand, the post-ritual Protestant aversion to metaphysics, still fairly common among Protestant theologians, especially in Germany. They need not be post-liberals need not be metaphysical relativists. Some ways of talking about the world are, in fact, more accurate than others. Some are just false. But the post-liberal theologians recognize that the map is not the territory. a metaphysical scheme, say, to pick a metaphysical scheme at total random, Thomas metaphysics, may grasp significant aspects of reality accurately. But that is not to say that the categories of the scheme simply are reality. There may be diverse ways of talking about some aspects of reality. There is always some tentativeness in post-liberal commitment to any elaborated metaphysical scheme. Two questions immediately arise here for the Thomist theologian, I think. How far is the Thomist theologian willing to engage in the discussion between Thomist philosophy, say, and the analytic philosophical tradition? Such an engagement is certainly going on among philosophers, and one can find a splendid theological example of taking this up in Marshall's Trinity and Truth. But is this a sideline of the present Thomist enterprise, or something more central? And what difference does it make if one grasps a certain gap between metaphysical categories and the reality being described? Let me give an example. There's a criticism of the Joint Declaration of Doctrine of Justification, Christopher Molloy, University of Dallas, and cited and grafted into Christ. I think he makes the mistake of thinking that certain kinds of metaphysical categories, particularly formal cause, simply are the way the world is. And if you can't fit Luther into a precise set of those categories, well, he must be wrong in certain senses. It might be that Luther is simply talking about things in a rather different kind of way, and it won't fit. Those particular categories are good for certain things, but again, map is not territory. A second consequence of the one consequence is a certain, I would say, tentativeness. Not relativism, but tentativeness about metaphysical categories. A second consequence of the philosophical turn to Oxford and Cambridge was a certain decentering of the self. The post-Kantian idealist tradition required a foundational understanding of the self and its consciousness. Experiential expressivism requires a strong sense, strong self that experiences and expresses. Wittgenstein, Ryle, and Austin undercut that self. And a rejection, I would note, of the idealist romantic self was in the air at the time. Think of the literary criticism of Roland Barthes, or the sociology of Irving Goffman, both of which undercut the notion of the centrality of the self. The self expressing itself in culture and language is paired in the post-liberals, even subordinated, to a self shaped by the cultural and linguistic forms available to it. As Lindbeck puts it, first come the objectivities of the religion, its language, doctrines, liturgies, and modes of action. And it is through these that the passions are shaped into various kinds of what is called religious experience. As that quotation indicates, a third consequence closely follows. I have three consequences, not two. I didn't go back and correct. A third consequence follows, a privileging of first-order discourse. The language of scripture, liturgy, devotion, over the second-order language of theology or the third-order language of formal doctrine. For Lindbeck, there's a primary language of daily discourse, Bible, liturgy especially, the second order, that might be something like the Summa, and then the third order, which rules theology, which would be something like the doctrines of the Council of Trent. It seems to me, here again I wish to be tentative, that for Lindbeck's understanding of truth, it is at the level of first-order theological language, with its close associations with the practices of the Christian life, that language and reality connect. Where there is a particular sort of adequation of Christian thought and practice to the reality of God. Theology of the sort to be found in issues of the Thomist is secondary, even parasitic, on that primary discourse of Bible, liturgy, and devotion. Second-level theological language does make truth claims, but the sense of its truth claims and the connection of its claims to reality, to what is the case, is mediated through the first-order discourse. Now, there have been versions of Thomism which indeed don't seem to follow this path. Although my sense, and I should say I am not a Thomas scholar, is that recent readings of Thomas are far more sympathetic to such a picture of the primacy of first-order discourse. I think any discussion of post-liberal theology and Thomism needs to look at this relation. Now, I've cheated a little bit. Under syllabus, reading analytic philosophy, I've talked about certain commitments also, but I wanted to talk about syllabus. So what made the Yale School itself was a certain concern, a certain reading list. And let me note, finally, and here I'll be fairly quick, virtues. There were certain virtues that sought to be embodied and inculcated. Above all, clarity. Now, as anyone who's actually read much of Frey and Lindbeck know, they may be somewhat taken aback. Hans Frey had many virtues. His writing was not always clear. As a colleague of mine who worked with him on rewriting one chapter said, he didn't know you could put the verbs at the ends of the clauses in German, I mean English. But there was a strong stress on clarity. This went with a high appreciation of analysis, a lack of appreciation for sloppy work. A second virtue was modesty, the avoidance of grandiose claims and grandiose programs. One reason there wasn't a sort of post-liberal manifesto, that just seemed to be too pushy, too much self-promotion. I think one way of understanding the difference, here I'm a little, this will be a little snarky, one way of understanding the difference between post-liberalism and radical orthodoxy is the different valuation of clarity and modesty. They have a different kind of place. This contrast, there's a discomfort, I think, with the very term, and the reason, I think, generally, for the thin production of large products. What large book did Hans Frey produce other than The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative? What do you put on the shelf? What book of Lindbeck's next to The Nature of Doctrine? There was a certain kind of reticence for producing large products. Third, a virtue of generosity. This comes in relation to Schleiermacher. Particularly when work is good, even if you disagree with it, you must respect it. There are things to be learned there. I think when I think back to the time that I studied at Yale and things that were inculcated in me, the virtues, I would say, of a certain kind of pursuit of clarity, a certain kind of appropriate modesty, not that these were not intellectually ambitious men, but self-promotion was not what they were about, for better or worse, and in terms of impact. And third, the issue of a kind of generosity. So the school, I think, of Yale in the 70s and 80s was typified by a concern, a reading list, certain virtues. Did or does post-liberal theology exist? Well, I'll grant, probably so. Various authors have tried to describe it, but the path I have taken here today is slightly different. I have tried to describe the Yale School as a school, a related but different thing. I have done so in large part because I had in mind the final question of my title, why care? This may seem counterintuitive. A school, in my sense, seems more bound in its time than a theological approach, but I don't think so. I've noted ways in which I believe the Yale School presents some challenges to at least some versions of Thomism and Catholic theology more generally. How does one interrelate the specificities of Christian discourse, both to more universal truths the Christian recognizes and to the specific extra-Christian views of the time? What is the relation of theology to the first-order discourse of the Christian life? How does scholastic, or more narrowly, Thomist philosophy interact with the dominant mode of academic philosophy of the English-speaking world? I am not sure post-liberalism as a theological position is the final answer to the questions I just asked, but I do think that the Yale theologies of the 1970s and 1980s made deeply helpful suggestions, and the Yale School exemplified a constructive and humane way to go about the conversations of these questions. It was a sheer gift of divine providence that I was led to study there with such professors and with such fellow students, and for that, I am simply grateful. Thank you.
Michael, we're gonna ask questions for about 10 minutes or so, but maybe 15. But I would be interested to take the prerogative to ask the first question. I was myself a freshman in college, assigned The Nature of Doctrine by Lindbeck, and was greatly helped by that text, and it affected me in important ways in thinking about the sort of role of theology. Now, I have become part of the tribe of, you know, the metaphysical Thomist camp that you described. And I understand what you say about, you know, the map of ontology is distinct from the territory, and that is, of course, very true, and it's important to be able to understand the, I think you called it first-order discourse, of other alternative accounts of reality represented by other philosophies. But this is always a question I sort of have about Lindbeck and maybe the Yale School approach to some extent, if it can be described as a unified approach, and that is, to what extent is there a kind of a suspension of commitment regarding any capacity to build up a coherent philosophical doctrine, precisely due to a kind of latent, I would call it implicitly philosophical, commitment to skepticism about, you know, kind of, is there a kind of Wittgensteinian version of nominalism or skepticism about the mind's capacity to attain universal stable knowledge of principles? So therefore, theology can work very fluidly with lots of different philosophies. Doctrine's not tied to any particular philosophy. I mean, I just wonder if there's a kind of philosophical commitment to it. It's a question I have.
Maybe it's also in what some others might say. I think I would say something like this, and this is now speaking for myself. I certainly am not expressing what Fry or Lindbeck might think, or my colleagues. I do think, coming out of the kind of education I received, you certainly can say that what the term substance refers to is real. A denial, say, of an integral human self, the way it would occur in somebody like Derek Parfit, or in some kinds of classical Buddhism, is false. That misreads the world in a fundamental way. But nevertheless, there may be a variety of ways of talking about substance that one is open to at least entertaining, at least as a discussion partner, not necessarily to adopt. It's not a lack of commitment that this does represent pretty well the way the world works, but a recognition that there might be other ways of talking about reality that pick up aspects of reality this doesn't. Or that shape these ways of speaking. I do think part of my concern here is ecumenical, particularly in relation to the Orthodox. I mean, I think if one is going to say, as I think we should, that as Catholics we're not closed to the accuracy of a far less scholastic way of doing theology, that their way of talking about the reality and faith is one we might prefer our own, we might think it's more accurate, we might think it's more precise, but we might say that captures aspects of reality we don't. So I wouldn't call it, if you want to say it, it's certainly the case is that one is rejecting a kind of, a certain kind of correspondence theory, which strikes me as perhaps no one ever held. I mean, of a sort of perfect adequation of mind and reality, where every aspect of reality shows up in our concepts. But I wouldn't call it skeptical. I would call it, I mean, I'm not sure what to call it. I do think post-liberalism is open to genuine ontological commitments, but understanding those commitments might be phrased in a variety of ways.
That seems very convergent
to me,
but maybe
Bruce could say this much better than I can.
But I'm not going to. I'm going to ask a question. Sort of an insider question, but I'm really interested in your answer. When you described the syllabus and said that Barton Schleiermacher were the magnetic poles, it immediately seemed to me that I would have said Thomas and Barton were the magnetic poles.
Bruce.
I don't know. They're not here.
I would have said that Thomas and Barton were the magnetic poles, with Schleiermacher a sort of necessary background to Barton. That may be just because I gravitated more towards I gravitated towards Lindbeck at times, particularly when Lindbeck was teaching seminars on Thomas, which maybe he wasn't doing when you were there. But it did make a difference, I think, in the way that the whole thing looked to me. I think this is wrong, but at the time it seemed seemed to me that I had to do justice to both Thomas and Hart and whatever I wanted to propose theologically.
It may be a difference of the time. It may be a difference of you and me. I do think I gravitated more to Fry than Lindbeck, although in the end, I think I ended up being more Lindbeckian in a certain sense than Fry, although that may have come later when I did ecumenical work and he finally published The Nature of Doctrine. I do think Chad Pecknold's book is very good on this. The Yale School of Post-Liberalism was not a static reality. It changed from even while I was there. It certainly changed in the early 80s. I can remember reading a famous article of Hans Frey on the literal sense, will it bend or does it break? Something like that. And being, I thought, oh, Frey's wrong. He's giving up the truth. And it took me a good while to come around in a certain sense. I wouldn't say, I have to ask Jim Buckley, I wouldn't say when I was there, Thomas was certainly not, and say, in the presentation of Lindbeck in the comparative dogmatics course, the seminar in Augustine that I did with Lindbeck, Thomas was nowhere near as prominent. He may very well have been 4 or 5 years later when you were there.
Well, I was there at the Eschaton in 88, and Thomas was certainly was very prominent. But sort of on this, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about similarities, differences, convergences between the Yale School and what I think of as another approach, theological approach, also heavily influenced by Wittgenstein, namely the British Dominicans, Victor White, then later Herbert McCabe and Fergus Carr, and I guess as an American outpost or colony, David Burrell. And I just don't, I wonder if you have any thoughts on how that approach compares to the post-liberal approach.
And here, because I don't know the British as well as I should, I do think a crucial difference. And again, this may represent my being there in the mid-70s rather than later, was the engagement with the tradition of Schleiermacher and theological liberalism. I do think those names I listed, Gordon Kaufman, Schubert Ogden, Langdon Gilkey, not the Tracy of analogical imagination, but the Tracy of blessed rage for order. There was a sense in 74, 75... of the real need to offer an alternative to a certain kind of American version of Protestant liberalism that seemed, after the long sort of neo-Orthodox period dominated by the Niebuhr brothers, Tillich, etc., as liberal tradition had rose up again in a particularly problematic form. I mean, the Gordon Kaufman's Something of Theological Method. What's the title? Something with Theological Method in the title.
Exactly.
Langdon Gilkey's Reaping the Whirlwind, Schubert Ogden's Reality of God. These looked to, certainly to Frey and Lindbeck, and I think even to Kelsey, as deeply problematic. And that would separate, I think, out the British, and certainly separate out Burrell. Now, the interaction, I just barely had time to look at it. The interaction and impact of Burrell would be quite interesting. And there are, this is the problem with defining post-liberalism. Does it include Burrell? Does it include Hauerwas? There is a book, a little book of interviews with post-liberal theologians that includes interviews with Hauerwas, Burrell, and Lindbeck. Now, are those the three paradigmatic figures for post-liberalism? Now I'm not sure. That's the difficulty of the term.
I was going to say, Herbert McCabe has an interesting response to Honest to God, Honest to God, which might make an interesting point of comparison to a response to liberal theology.
And here, however,
and to Morris Wallace.
This may be too biographical, but I do think it was an insider problem for Frey and Lindbeck. They were Protestants. Mm. And thus it was a different dynamic, I think, particularly for Frey. I don't remember Frey engaging Catholic theology deeply, at least within he was very much a part of that tradition. Paul DeHart mentions the way in which Tracy's Blessed Rage for Order became the paradigm of what Fry didn't want to do, that he thought it was a mistake. And that I think that sets it apart when it's inside one's own tradition. It's a little bit different.
I have two questions. One of them is, were your professors at Yale also engaged in preaching and ministry in the local church?
Limbeck was a layman. Fry's relation with the church, how to put it, fraught. He was an Anglican. He had been a Episcopal priest up on the New Hampshire-Vermont Canada border between Divinity School and Graduate School. The reality of the Episcopal Church drove him crazy. Would that be too... I remember once at graduation, it was Paul Moore. He used to be the Bishop of New York. He was a sort of perfect, sort of aristocratic liberal. And he was something on the Yale Corporation. We'd do these speeches at graduation. And for some reason, I was in Fry's office when he came back. And you could see the smoke coming out of Fry's ears. So Fry's relation, I mean, as Episcopal priest. David Kelsey, I just don't remember. But certainly Fry, and Limbeck was a layman. And Fry's relation with ministry of his church was problematic.
I wonder because of Yale Divinity School, of course, is principally ordered to training ministers and preachers.
Right.
How that theological school affected preaching in the local church?
That would be a good question. And I do think the actual impact of both Fry and Limbeck was to open you back up to a way of reading scripture that's more useful for preaching. I mean, a more typological, bringing out the literary connections, which are in people's heads anyway. I mean, you're not going to stand there in a congregation and read the suffering servant songs and not have people think it's about Jesus. I mean, it's not going to work. So a sermon that then feels much freer for when you come to the sacrifice of Isaac of talking about the cross, when you come to the suffering servant songs to talk about Jesus, to make these kinds of connections... is far more conducive to, it seems to me, vital preaching than an approach to theology that bans those ways of reading scripture. And I think that was one of the most important impacts of post-liberal theology, which again is now simply spread out and is no longer particularly distinctive.
Second question, very briefly. Yes. What's happening at Yale now? Is there any continuity?
There is... the main professor of theology at Yale that I know is Catherine Tanner, who is a Fry student. But I think Catherine Tanner, who is very, very smart, there's no doubt about that. But I would say I think she exemplifies the ambiguity of the post-liberal tradition as a mediating theology, which tends to fall out on one side or the other. I would say... Catherine Tanner is a very, very smart person. I've no doubt she's a faithful, faithful follower in her own lights, but I mean, I find her theology just to abandon fundamental teachings in ways that as I couldn't as a Lutheran and can't as a Catholic. But yes, there's a certain continuity in that sense. But as she was gone and has only come back, I do think the problem with the death of Fry in 1988, Limbeck retiring in the 90s. I won't go into details, but I think there were hirings that were done, did not continue that tradition. I do think during the 90s, post-liberalism as the Yale school ceased to be.
We'll take a last question from the bishop.
Michael, I remember the seminar with Lindbeck on Catholic theology. He did a comparison of Rahner and von Balthasar. And that was a real interest of his, I think, in the 80s. I was talking to Bruce during the break about this. But what I do remember is, he saw, I mean, at this time, Balthasar was perceived as a kind of Catholic Bardian ally. But there was never any engagement with Balthasar's philosophical investigations, the third part of the trilogy, for example. I mean, he never engaged any of that. And years later, I think it may have been at the same conference where you spoke to him, 2010, 2009. Right. I asked him, when did your interest in Balthasar wane? And he couldn't remember.
all to Lindbeck.
Yeah. But I just wonder if you might, you know, comment on that. You know, that was a, was it sort of a brief flirtation with Balthasar and a someone who kind of resonated with the post-liberal project, but, you know, ultimately was dropped as an interest.
Yeah. That I can't say much about. When I was working at Yale was before the Balthasar stuff appeared in English, and some of it before it appeared in German. So it wasn't alive at the time. I do think sometimes Balthasar is seen as a kind of Catholic version of post-liberalism. I think that's not the case. What's going on in Balthasar is something I think rather different. So I just can't comment. At the time, when Lindbeck had a very strong interest in Rahner and Lonergan. It's interesting, Thomas Stransky, some people may know him, he the last man alive, still alive, who was on the staff of the Secretariat for Christian Unity at the beginning of Vatican II. And he remembers George Lindbeck. George Lindbeck was an observer at Vatican II, and the Lutheran World Federation didn't just hire him to be an observer during the sessions of the Council in the fall. He was employed for 2 years, full time. He moved his wife and young daughter over to Rome. And what he remembered about Lindbeck, well, it was his daughter. Lindbeck said this was, a bishop who could have people over, and they loved a baby to play with, something unusual in the Vatican II context. And second, I can't remember if he said it was Rahner or Lonergan, that Lindbeck was obsessed that he had to understand this theologian. And he was working mightily. And I can't remember if he said it was Rahner or Lonergan at the time. I do think Lindbeck, remember, he did his dissertation on Duns Scotus. I mean, he had an engagement with Catholicism from early on. Had these interests, but... perhaps it's not atypical that he began a certain interest in Balthasar and then found it wasn't quite what he might have initially thought.
Just could I say something quick about this very quick? In the Wright book, the interview with Lindbeck is fascinating. I mean, he speaks very openly,
right.
But he mentions that it was reading the manuscript as a reader for Princeton, of Victor Prelos, The Divine Science
and the Science of God,
and making the suggestion to the press that Preller then fulfilled that he should discuss Rahner.
Right.
Lindbeck says that he, at that time, he was beginning to see that there were very serious problems with Rahner's theology. So
yeah.
By the time we were there then,
73. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, right.
He was already, I think he began to see the problems that I then began to
yeah.
see in Rahner, which I'll talk about tomorrow. But it's that that Wright book, I mean, I didn't read the other interviews, but I was very interested to read the one about Lindbeck because he's quite open about many things that I just never aware of,
right.
Which I'd read it a long time ago. It's 2005 interview.
If I could make one comment before we end.
Yes.
What's interesting, one forgets that Lindbeck began as a medievalist.
Sorry.
And a history of 14th and 15th century theology. There's a fascinating article from 1959, well before the Vatican II stuff comes up at all, on Pierre Dailly and why was nominalism popular? I mean, everybody dumps on it, and yet for two centuries, everybody found this fascinating. I mean, you know, people weren't stupid. How could they have become nominalists? You know, we're cursed on in a Dominican house. And one thing that's interesting is that he notes the similarity between medieval nominalism and analytic philosophy. Both of them concerned with logic. He thinks there are similar problems in both of them. They develop this enormously powerful technical apparatus that nobody but insiders can understand. What's interesting here is both, I want to say a good word for nominalism here, its power, such as that, but also the way he was already in 1959, well before his engagement ecumenically, etc., was already aware of bringing together scholastic and analytic categories. That was clearly in his mind in this 59 Harvard Theological Review essay, which is, I must say, strikingly interesting. We lost a great historian of medieval theology when he went to Vatican II.